Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, the podcast channel with the New Books Network that features interviews with philosophers about their recently published books. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel, along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt. Today's interview is with Jill Gordon, Charles A. Dana Professor of Philosophy at Colby College. Her new book is Plato's Erotic World, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. It's traditional in Plato scholarship to divide his dialogues in various ways. One division is a temporal one into what are considered early, middle, and late dialogues. Another is by content. There are the so-called erotic dialogues, which include such dialogues as Symposium, Phaedrus, and Alcibiades, where themes of love and friendship are explicitly treated. And then there's the rest of them, which deal with such non-erotic themes as language and knowledge and ontology. But in her new book, Professor Gordon argues that this second division deeply misinterprets the role of eros throughout the Platonic corpus, and that even what are taken to be non-erotic dialogues, such as Theaetetus, Parmenides, and Phaedo, are deeply erotic, and that the theme of eros unifies the corpus rather than divides it. For example, the Socratic dialectic, or elenchus, is a give and take that is erotic in nature, and doing philosophy itself is an erotic endeavor akin to naked exercise in the gymnasium. Her argument begins with a close reading of Timaeus, Plato's creation myth, and the role of eros in the immortal human soul, and it comes full circle with a reading of the Phaedo, in which Socrates' growing rigidity as the hemlock takes hold is also an erotic pun. Let's turn to the interview. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you, and thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about my work.
Yeah, this is great. Plato's Erotic World. You give a defense of the importance of eros in Plato's dramatic world, and you're trying to undermine traditional interpretations of key dialogues to show them as deeply erotic. And that's a pretty interesting approach, because, you know, Plato, of course, is one of the philosophers who is so widely known and widely discussed, and to give a new interpretation like this is really pretty exciting.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's one of those projects where you're sort of working on it thinking, wow, this is really eccentric. And then, you know, you kind of have two choices: to think that maybe you might move the center to some other place, or, you know, really just convince people to think about these dialogues differently. So yeah, it's a little bit of a crazy project to think about Parmenides and Cratylus and Theaetetus and Phaedo and so forth as erotic dialogues, but that's what I'm doing.
So let me, before we get into the book itself, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit about how you got into philosophy and what led you to doing ancient philosophy, and then in particular, what led you to this book.
So I would say for me, philosophy was love at first sight, and that was my very first day in college. I took an introductory course with Professor John Roth at the Claremont Colleges at CMC, And I just really fell in love. I think we read The Apology first. Of course, being a young person, I thought I had to do something quote unquote practical. So I was actually an economics major. But John Roth really mentored me and helped me to think about philosophy eventually as a major my senior year, because I had taken so many classes anyway, and then as a career. And I'm just really grateful for that. And of course, I have stayed with my first love, ancient philosophy.
And what got you to the topic of this book?
Well, it started out really just a couple of articles that I wrote, trying to think through whether erotic desire could be found in some other dialogues. I started with what became the first chapter, the Timaeus, and it really had a kind of organic life of its own. It did not start as a book project. I thought I would write one article. And then I thought, oh, gosh, maybe I'll write another article. I think maybe there's some erotic things in this other dialogue. And before I knew it, I started thinking in broader terms, maybe Eros is something kind of like Socratic ignorance, that it's deeply fundamental to who we are as human beings. And if that's so, then it would be something Plato is very much concerned with across the dialogues. And so I would say it wasn't really until maybe 2-3 years into those other projects that I started thinking about this as a book.
So the first thing I guess we should probably clarify is how you understand the term Eros and also what you call Plato's world or Plato's dramatic world.
Okay. I want to say one other thing before I get to that, and mm-hmm. that is that this book contains work on pretty much every dialogue that really intimidates me. And so I want to just give a shout out to all the scholars who have devoted their lives to really painstaking work on these incredibly complex dialogues, because I could not have done this project without them, just to guide me through them and help me understand what's going on in them. So, first of all, I guess I'll start with Eros. It does take me pretty much the whole book to flesh out the concept, but I can give a kind of preliminary account, and then maybe through our conversation that will also get fleshed out. Eros is, first of all, a primordial human desire, and it arises from our original alienation from being, or, you know, being, capital B. This happens in the act of individuation when soul becomes souls. And I'm taking this, by the way, from the Timaeus. And so Eros is a kind of mark on humans, or a sign in humans, of this alienation. And so it's a kind of desire aimed at, it's a desire aimed at disalienation. That's one way to think about it, or a reunification with being. Now, that's a very abstract way to think about it. But in a concrete way, as embodied beings, of course, our Eros gets expressed in a lot of different ways. Sexual attraction to other beings is, of course, at the top of the list. But I also argue in the book that it gets expressed in doing philosophy generally, asking questions, thinking hypothetically, and very generally in our desire to know a lot of things that really lie beyond the desire, or excuse me, lie beyond the abilities of people to know.
Okay. So, you draw an arc in the book, that echoes the arc of the life cycle before we get to that,
Plato's world.
Yeah, right. Cause I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Plato's world, I'm sorry, I forgot that part of the question. So I wanted to make the point that Plato's concerns with Eros were as broad as possible for any philosopher. That is, I wanted to really expand our thinking about Plato's concern for Eros beyond the erotic dialogues. And Plato's world really captures that. And so what I mean by Plato's world is this fictive creation that Plato has created through all of the dialogues when you look at them as a whole. Now, as people who read Plato know, it's a very vivid world, and we can really enter it, and we tell stories about it, and we feel we know and understand the characters who inhabit it, and we understand the locations where philosophy takes place, and we kind of get the logic of that world. Now, of course, it's also a world that has some inconsistencies in it, but it's nonetheless coherent enough to provide a kind of complete picture. And so what I do in the book, how I describe or capture that complete picture, is I begin from the origins of the cosmos, which we have in the Timaeus, and that includes, of course, the creation of human beings. And then I look at four dialogues that trace human life and especially the cultivation of the human soul in various ways. And then finally, I turn to human death in the Phaedo and look at that as a kind of return to origins. So it's an entire world, but it's also a cycle. It's a life cycle of a human life.
Yeah, so that's why you draw a really nice arc in the book that sort of comes full circle in this way. You're beginning with the Timaeus and going through Cratylus, Parmenides, Theaetetus, and some other dialogues, and then back to Phaedo, where mm-hmm. Socrates is dying and then finally does die. So beginning with the creation myth in the Timaeus, traditionally, Eros is mapped onto the appetitive part of the tripartite soul in the Republic. And of course that is as appetite, that of course is supposed to be controlled by reason, right, you know, in the well-ordered soul. And you contest this, you know, very common reading. And so as a result, our noetic activity, our pursuit of knowledge in general, is, as you interpret it, an erotic pursuit.
Yes.
So can you explain your very, this is a critical part of your whole argument is how you see the creation myth and the immortal soul and its relation to the mortal soul.
Right. Okay. So I'll talk a little bit about the nous. A little bit about Eros and the appetites, and then try to take up nous after that. So, on my reading of the Timaeus, I think it's really unfortunate that Eros gets mapped onto the appetitive part of the soul. What we see more generally in the dialogues, actually, is that Eros is pretty consistently associated with the divine. And that it has the power to channel human desire in positive and even divine directions. Epithumia is never associated with the divine. I'll say a little bit about the Republic, and then I want to kind of set that aside because I'm, as you say, I'm arguing against importing that Republic's view of the tripart soul into the Timaeus, with which it's inconsistent. In the Timaeus, what we see is that Eros is what drives us to noetic understanding. So Eros is actually prior to nous, and I think that's just really important. As you say, I do spend a fair bit of time in the book arguing against this traditional view that wants to link the Timaeus with the Republic. The other thing that I think is really central to how the Timaeus presents Eros in the human soul is that it makes it very clear that Eros is an active aspect of the human soul and that epithumia is passive. And that the very activity that Eros takes up is this drive towards noetic entities or stimulating nous, if you will. I work towards this moment in the Timaeus where Timaeus makes it really clear that what the soul does is desire in an erotic way. He uses a cognate of Eros, noetic objects. Now, I don't know if this is maybe getting a little far afield, but we can sort of, Plato is thought of by a lot of philosophers as kind of this prototypical rationalist. And I think that's why we want to think of nous or episteme even as these grounding fundamental things in human beings. And clearly the Republic is a dialogue where, you know, these things rule in the soul and so forth. But although Plato's a kind of rationalist, I think that we need to ask the question, okay, but what's the driving force behind human knowing and human understanding? And the Timaeus, and by the way, other dialogues as well, we can talk a little bit later about recollection, but other things really drive human beings to that kind of philosophical inquiry that might result in nous or episteme. So I'm really trying to get at the priority of episteme over nous.
So what is, on your view, what is the relation between the human immortal soul and then the human mortal soul?
Right. So I do a very close reading of these two passages in the Timaeus, which a traditional reading of that dialogue has claimed are just, the second one is merely a recapitulation of the first. And I'll kind of shorten my take on that. I basically make two arguments against taking the second account as merely recapitulating the first. I think that the first account is an account of the immortal soul as it's created by the demiurge, or at least started by the demiurge. And then I take the second argument very clearly to be the mortal soul, which has degenerated and which is corrupted to a certain degree by the lesser gods having taken over and made it embodied or enfleshed. So the first argument that I make has simply to do with comparing the language of the two passages. And the second passage includes negative adjectives throughout. And so what appears in the first passage as merely a description of the soul having this or that faculty, in the second passage, it describes that faculty in a negative way. The second, and I think really salient aspect of the relationship between these two arguments is that the first one takes place in the first part of the Timaeus, where Timaeus is giving noetic creation. And the second one takes place in the part of the dialogue after the so-called new beginning or second start that Timaeus makes, where he's going to talk about this other world, this material world of necessity. And so it's a very different argument. So I think that's how we want to think about the immortal soul versus the mortal soul. And I make it clear that the immortal soul, in fact, includes eros. Again, eros as a mark of this initial alienation from being.
So let's step back for a moment from Plato's dramatic world and draw some sort of a relationship to our world. I mean, Timaeus is a creation myth. How does your reading of Plato inform how we should understand humans from, you know, the materialist or evolved biological perspective that we, you know, tend to have?
Well, sadly, I don't think it does inform or could inform a more materialist or biological perspective on humans. I think Plato's world is really steeped in non-material origins of humans and other ensouled beings. And if we're talking about the Timaeus, of course, the world itself has these non-material origins. Now, that said, I think you could make the move of thinking about whether there are fundamental desires, as in the way that I'm talking about eros as a fundamental desire, that have material bases and that drive human behavior. I think we could talk about Nietzsche in this way. You know, Nietzsche really has a very biological and species-focused idea about humanity. And so maybe if we wanted to talk about Nietzsche's understanding of human life and the will to power in human life, that might be a move. Or Freud, of course, following in Nietzsche's footstep. And, you know, maybe contemporary geneticists or neurobiologists might want to explain fundamental human desires. But I just don't know that we can get that from Plato's worldview.
Okay, fair enough.
Unless you know something I don't, maybe there's something I'm just not thinking about here.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's a background assumption of the book that some sort of substance dualism is true, and since you know many people today, you know, don't think that that's true. One would not want to simply say, well, because the whole Platonic corpus depends on substance dualism, therefore it's irrelevant. That is sort of the issue.
Right. Well, I guess I feel the following way. If we want to talk about what I think is really relevant to our lives right now from my reading of this, I think I can get that without having to agree with Plato's particular view of the human soul and its origins and so forth. I think the chapters that talk about how we might cultivate our desires and how joining into particular kinds of relations with human beings might help us to guide those desires in proper ways, that's really, I think, useful and could be formative, even if we don't accept this very, what I'm saying is a non-materialist account of the origins of the human soul. Or a non-materialist account of Eros in particular.
Good. Well, so let's move on to one of the the first aspect of self-cultivation that you discuss in the Cratylus, which is again usually taken as a dialogue in philosophy of language and ontology. And your interpretation relates Eros and the interrogative state that even the give and take of and questioning of the Socratic Alenchus is itself erotic, and questioning, the act of questioning, is, on your view, a risky expression of a lack of something that's missing and of a desire to satisfy that lack. So maybe you could, you know, tell us a bit about your interpretation of Cratylus.
Sure. I want to just say by way of preface that I describe in my introduction that none of the chapters is intended to be a kind of full-blown interpretation of a single dialogue, but really to do a thorough treatment of how Eros appears in that dialogue and to think about it against the backdrop of it. So with that said, my reading of Cratylus is based primarily on two parts of it. First of all, the introductory first several pages in which Socrates and Hermogenes actually engage in an alanctic exchange. And then secondly, one of the etymologies that comes in the bulk of the dialogue. For people who've not read it, this dialogue contains at its core a series of etymologies that Socrates just sort of spouts out. So I start with the alanctic part, and I focus on Socrates' insistence in that exchange with Hermogenes that the dialectician is the person who is expert at asking questions. That's what defines the dialectician. And furthermore, the dialectician is extremely important because it's the dialectician who rules or guides or supervises, depending on how you want to translate this word, the person who makes correct names. This is a dialogue about naming. So this person who makes correct names, the nomothetes, it works under the guidance or supervision of the dialectician, the person who knows how to ask questions. So I think this hierarchy with the questioner on top kind of looms in the background of this dialogue. It's really the upshot of that first alanctic part of the dialogue. So as Socrates and Hermogenes then move on to the etymologies, I want to be thinking about this. Okay, why is it important that someone who asks questions is kind of supervising how we name things? So I then turn to one of the etymologies in particular, which is Socrates' explanation for the derivation of the word hero. And he takes three Greek words here and links them, here the word for hero, the word for eros, and the word for questioning. And they all are, they're homophones. They sound very similar. And then the etymology he gives is, well, you know, heroes are called this because they spring from eros, from the erotic love between mortals and immortals. Or, he says, the other reason that heroes might be called heroes is that they are clever dialecticians and question askers. So I sort of take this etymology seriously, not as a true origin of this word, but as Plato making some serious links between these concepts, hero eros and question asking. So I'll set aside the hero part because that actually helps to link this chapter to the next, which is on courage. Mm-hmm. But I do probe then this link between eros and question asking. So I go to the symposium now, which I do go to the traditional erotic dialogues to kind of open up these other texts and to help me think through them. And I look at the language that Plato uses there in the symposium, and I show that in the symposium, in Diotima's speech, she is repeatedly punning on exactly these same two words for questioning and eros. This pushes me to ask whether there's a deeper connection between questioning and eros, that this is quite conscious on Plato's part. And I make the case that, in fact, they do have a very common basis, eros and questioning. And that basis is a desire, a lack, a recognition of that lack, and then a desire to remedy it. That's where questions come from. They come from recognizing one's lack and having a desire to remedy it. So then I turn to Socrates' claims to ignorance, which are very well known. And the claim in the symposium that he is an expert on eros. And some people think this is really paradoxical.
Right.
He says, you know, I don't know anything. Also claim I'm an expert on eros. And I try to say that this connection between questioning and eros gives us the answer to that question. Socrates is an expert on eros because he's an expert on asking questions, because he's ignorant. And this is why I claim that the Socratic method is erotic, and why I claim that dialogues are erotic, all of them, because Socrates is engaging in erotic activity merely by asking questions.
You also characterized Meno's paradox, which is, you know, one of the more famous passages in the dialogues in the Meno, as itself deeply erotic, which I thought was pretty interesting. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, actually, my point is that the paradox is anti-erotic. The whole upshot of that moment in the dialogue, you know, it's really this dramatic, heavy moment. Meno's paradox, it's not just about kind of throwing a wrench in the works in his conversation with Socrates. It throws a wrench in the works for any inquiry whatsoever. You know, it basically says, look, humans, what's the point of investigating any further? And so I think if we take questioning as an erotic activity, then it stands to reason that sophistic modes of speech making and giving answers and being confident in your answers and not being at a loss, this is anti-erotic behavior. It really forestalls questioning.
I thought that was a very, you know, interesting addition to my understanding of the paradox, for sure. Now, in the Parmenides, you connect, as you mentioned, eros with courage, and in particular, the courage of asking questions, revealing oneself to have a lack and to desire to have it, you know, corrected or overcome. And you also characterize philosophy itself as an erotic endeavor because of this relation to questioning, and you draw the relationship between philosophy and naked exercise in the gymnasium, right?
Yes. Which
is something that, you know, few philosophers or philosophy students think of what they're doing. In fact, if word got out, you know, we might get a lot more majors. but could you expand on that reading of certain passages, at least of Parmenides?
Sure, and I'll try to be as concise as I can. It gets a fairly complicated to talk about Parmenides. So, I guess what I'd like to do is maybe divide my answer. I want to talk a little bit about why I read the Parmenides as an erotic dialogue, and that's a way for me to actually get to this passage you're talking about, which indeed comes from the Theaetetus, where Socrates makes reference to naked wrestling. But there, it's all of a piece. So, I'll try to be pretty concise about this. So, the first thing that I would want to say about the Parmenides is that although a lot of philosophers agree that Plato often introduces really important philosophical themes in his dialogues in the very early passages, or what some people call the prologues, and that he does this through setting and characterization and so forth. In my opinion, there wasn't very much literature that did that adequately with the Parmenides. I think it has a really fascinating first part. So on my reading of the Parmenides, it's a thoroughly and unapologetically erotic dialogue. So let me say a little bit about why I think that. First of all, it details the lover-beloved relationship between Parmenides and Zeno. And it's brought up twice. It's brought up first in the framing story that's told by Antiphon, right? Antiphon is relating the content of this conversation that Socrates had with Parmenides. So the framing story contains reference to this erotic relationship to Parmenides and Zeno. And then again, in the interior dialogue, Socrates himself brings it up in a kind of inappropriate way with Zeno. And kind of needles Zeno about being Parmenides' favorite. Then secondly, there's a poem that Parmenides cites fairly early in the dialogue. It's an Ibycus poem, and people might remember that Ibycus is he's a lyric poet. He writes erotic poetry. And he's also the poet who is referenced very briefly in the Phaedrus. So Parmenides makes a reference to an Ibycus poem, and he uses it to describe how he feels when Socrates asks Parmenides to carry out this demonstration that then takes up the bulk of the dialogue, all of the hypothetical deductions. And this poem is incredibly erotic. In the poem, Parmenides likens himself to an old horse. That the poem is about an old horse, but Parmenides says, "I feel like the old horse." And in the poem, the old horse is called by the god Eros. And Eros urges the old horse to the race. And the horse feels that because of Eros's charms, he has to go to the race, even though he's unwilling to go. And he's old and not really up for it. The full text of this poem is in Proclus, and even though Parmenides just cites a couple of lines. So on an explicit level, Parmenides is invoking Eros in an erotic poem, and he's saying Eros will drive him on to complete this really difficult philosophical task that he's just about to do. On a more figurative level, the horse is a common phallic stand-in in comedy and poetry. And so, you know, there's one way to read this, as I say in the book, that Parmenides is saying, look, you know, I'm not sure I can get it up anymore, you know, philosophically speaking, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm kind of erotically urged on to this task. So those few little dramatic details really set up my reading. Oh, and I should say one other. The setting of this dialogue, the inner dialogue, takes place during the Panathenaea, a festival, and the festival, as we know, includes a torch race that ran from the altar of Eros to, which is somewhere near the academy, to the altar of Anteros, or reciprocal love, which is at the base of the Acropolis. So it's clearly, there's so many signals in the early parts of this dialogue that they're ensconced in a kind of erotic environment. Okay, so that said, now let me just, and I should also say then the link to courage is it's going to take Parmenides a lot of courage to do this thing, to get back in this race, to give this very difficult hypothetical deduction. So if it's okay with you, Carrie, I'd like to sort of leave the courage thing right on the back burner for just a minute and see one more thing about my interpretation of Parmenides, why I think it's so deeply erotic. And then I'll come back to this naked wrestling thing. So there's a point in the deductions that is really important, and a lot of ink has been spilled about what it means. It comes right after the second hypothesis, and Parmenides is describing all the antinomies that follow from this second hypothesis, that the one is both at rest and in motion, that the one is neither temporal nor atemporal, and that the one is neither becoming nor being. And Parmenides says that there are some there's some strange thing, autopos is the Greek that he used, some strange thing that fits this description. And he says this is what we call the instantaneous. The Greek word here is exiphnes. It can also mean all of a sudden. Okay, so it's this tertiary ontological mode. So it's somehow between all of these things. Now, scholars agree pretty unanimously that this is an absolutely crucial point in the dialogue, but they don't agree why. They have lots of different explanations for why this weird little anomaly in the deductions is important. So I take this in a very different direction, and I try to make some connections to the repeated use of this notion of exiphnes, the all of a sudden, the instantaneous. And I link it to the Symposium, where this term also has a really prominent role. In the Symposium, the lover's noetic revelation is this flash, this insight, ta exiphnes, this instantaneous flash. And we know also from the Symposium that Eros bridges these kinds of modal gaps between being and coming, mortal, immortal, or divine and human, and so forth. It's a kind of disalienating moment, if you will. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the connections then that I make between Symposium and Parmenides, trying to think about how Eros has a role in these deep ontological questions. Okay, so then to this naked wrestling. So if we look back at the Parmenides and we take very seriously what Parmenides says about how much courage it's going to take to go through this very difficult deduction, and by the way, there are other marks in the dialogue where he really tries to buck up Socrates' own courage, the young Socrates.
Right.
So when I turn to the Theaetetus, I look at this really nice metaphor where Theodorus, the older teacher of Theaetetus, is trying to wriggle out of engaging in question and answer with Socrates. And we could say it's because he lacks the courage. I mean, it's kind of a scary thing to subject yourself to Socrates' questioning. And so Socrates says, you know, do you mean to tell me that you're going to let people go out there and wrestle naked while you stand here fully clothed and watch on and look on? And I take it as a metaphor for the vulnerability and exposure that it takes to really get down there and wrestle with deep philosophical problems. And of course, it's a challenge that Theodorus is not willing to take up. He basically says, yeah, I'd love to watch some naked people wrestle while I'm fully clothed if they'll let me. I take very seriously this metaphor and the erotic connections that it has. I draw heavily, too, on Scanlon's work on erotics in Greek athletics, where he talks in great detail about the erotics involved in naked wrestling in particular, but also just generally the homosocial environment surrounding the palaestra, the setting of many, many of Plato's dialogues, including Theaetetus. So that's why I think it takes courage and why I think Socrates uses this metaphor of naked wrestling.
Well, let me just, before I do want to get back to your discussion of Theaetetus directly, but as you just mentioned, the whole context of this, of Eros, as it's discussed in Plato, by Plato, is between men, right?
Yes. As,
Parmenides, yeah, and Zeno, and Socrates himself, and Alcibiades, and so on. And so, you know, it sort of raises the question of whether, you know, his view of Eros is necessarily between men and youths, or is that just a matter of, you know, the social conditions that he lived in. I mean, poor, you know, Socrates' wife, Xanthippe, is completely left out. And so it sort of raises the question of how, you know, generalizable, you know, this whole reading might be to include female souls as well as male souls, or maybe they just fundamentally differ.
Yes, yes. Poor Xanthippe. I have in the back of my mind some project someday of writing a comic novel from her point of view. I think that would be a lot of fun. So this is a wonderful can of worms that I think my work does open, but doesn't deal with completely. I do deal to a certain degree with the Greek homosocial world and gender in that regard. So perhaps there could be some more future work on gender in a more robust way than I've done. But I can say a few things about this. It's really sad, I think, that there's that moment in the Republic where Socrates tells us that, you know, of course, the women should train amongst the men and be able to compete and so on and so forth. Of course, it gets dropped, that idea of the philosopher, the women becoming philosopher kings or queens really drops out of the picture. And Socrates does not follow through on its consequences. In the dialogues that I'm dealing with in this book, I'm afraid there's not a lot that's hopeful for us gals. In fact, even in the Timaeus, Timaeus speaks in generic terms when he's talking about the creation of souls. But then near the end of the dialogue, when he's talking about what happens to corrupt souls, he reveals that the punishment for corrupt souls is that they are going to return as women.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah. So, yes, it's really sad. Now, that seems to cast in a really different light how we think about the creation of souls in that origin story. Some scholars think that it necessarily implies that they're all male, but there's disagreement about that. It might not necessarily imply that in the beginning when the souls are created that they're male. And Cornford ventures an opinion on this, and Kalkovich also has an opinion. So it's a particular conundrum, really, because so much of Western philosophy uses this generic language about humans, about souls, and all these kinds of concepts when they're dealing with human beings. But then these are put alongside very clear references to men and masculine culture. So what I do talk about in the book are things like the palaestra, horse racing, which is another venue of homosocial connection, athletics generally, and warfare. Those play a role in all of the dialogues that I look at. So I am thinking of this as, at least from Plato's writer vantage point as a writer, these are dialogues about men's connection to other men. And it's clear that Plato is talking about that with regard to Eros. I'd like to think that Diotima had an erotic soul. And I'd like to think that even though Plato might be focused on the male homosocial world, that we might expand that world a little bit and think about all human beings.
So in the Theaetetus, of course, there's the metaphor of the midwife, which is a female, traditionally female role. So at least there's that, right, where he does draw that connection.
Yes.
but you also, to get to your chapter on Theaetetus and its connection with Eros, you suggest that that this role of midwife also has, I think, some sort of extension to involve matchmaking.
Yes.
So maybe you could tell us about how you interpret at least certain passages in Theaetetus.
Great, yes. So the Theaetetus makes it really clear that there are these two aspects to the midwifery. He elaborates on this, Socrates does, and I really think it deserved more attention. It doesn't get a lot of attention in the secondary literature. I think scholarship has primarily focused on the aspects of the metaphor of delivery and giving birth, and then, you know, the viability of the ideas once they're delivered from the soul. And I think the matchmaking part of this metaphor actually gets us to think about the before as opposed to the after. That is, how two fertile souls might be brought together to beget, to get something. And I just thought that was really important. So the passage itself, Socrates says, you know, I'm a midwife and not very many people know this about me and so forth. But then he also says that midwives also do this other thing. There's this other aspect to their work, but they don't like to talk about it very much because they do this really legitimate thing, but it's easy to understand it in its illegitimate practice. That is, they're matchmakers, but they don't want to be thought of as pimps or pimpers. It's really sort of funny, I think. So I look very carefully at this and, again, try to think broadly about what Plato might be up to here. And the word that's used here for matchmaker is promnestra, and it means literally one who solicits for another. But its root is this verb, nomai, that's an M and an N or a mu and a nu together. And it means to be mindful. So what the matchmaker does is to bring to the mind of another the person she's trying to fix them up with. What's really fascinating to me is that this bringing to mind, this promnestra, matchmaking, shares the same root with anamnesis, which is recollection. As we know, the primary way in which we as humans are connected to noetic objects while we're embodied beings. And so I started thinking very sort of taking this idea of matchmaking in this philosophical direction and wanting to think about how matchmaking could happen both on a human-to-human level, matching one's soul to the soul of another who could be a guide or a teacher, which I talk about later in the book, but then also another kind of matchmaking that we try to introduce or bring to mind the forms to people's mind. That's what recollection is, to bring those things to mind. So there's some connections, and we'll talk about this later, I suppose, connections to my last chapter on the Phaedo, in which I take up recollection again, or take up anamnesis.
Yeah, so there are two topics that you just mentioned that I do want to pick up on. One is so in chapter 5, when you do turn directly to dialogues that are classified as erotic, and you talk about self-knowledge and yeah. the idea of guidance, you know, particularly by an older lover for the younger one. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could say something about that.
Sure. I think it's important to note why I turned to these two erotic dialogues. When I started fleshing out what I thought the book would look like and thinking about this arc of self-cultivation, of these things that one does with one's soul to cultivate Eros in the right ways, of course, thought, well, self-knowledge, that seems to be an important aspect of self-cultivation in the Platonic dialogues. And lo and behold, it turns out that if you look at the indices of both the Hamilton Cairns Plato collection and the Cooper Plato collection, they both show that self-knowledge is treated only in the traditional erotic dialogues. Mm-hmm. That was really fascinating to me. So that really got me thinking about, okay, so what is it about Eros and self-knowledge that is so entangled or entwined? So in this chapter, then, I turn to both the Alcibiades I and to Phaedrus. I do a fairly robust reading of the first, and I draw on the Phaedrus for support of that reading. The Alcibiades is a dialogue, as I read it, about erotic guidance through a kind of Socratic seduction. In this instance, of course, ultimately a failed seduction, though successful in the small context of this one dialogue. The image of the self-seeing eye is really central to this dialogue. This is the image when Socrates is urging Alcibiades to get self-knowledge, to have self-knowledge. And he says that the way you do this, you know, how do you look at your own soul? How do you do that? Well, Socrates says that the way you do that is, it's like if you wanted to see your own pupil. How do you get to see your own pupil? Well, you have to look into something that's going to reflect your own eye back to you so that you can see your own pupil. So you get this reflexive image. Self-knowledge doesn't come directly through looking into yourself through an interior. It's a reflexive process. And you get it by, he says, looking into the eyes of your lover who reflects back to you your true soul, your true self. So just as you see your own pupil by looking into the eye of another, so you see your own soul by looking at yourself reflected back to you through your lover. So I take really seriously this idea that self-knowledge has to come then through relation, and in particular through erotic relation. And where the Phaedrus comes in then is really to support this connection between eros and guidance. And I look there at the way in which leading and being led are thematized in the Phaedrus. And just if you look again at the very opening parts of the dialogue, when Socrates and Phaedrus first meet up, and he's being led to stroll along the river and get to the plane tree, leading and being led is mentioned 9 times just in that short little walk to the plane tree. Mm-hmm. And it's also significant that the verb that's used here for leading and being led comes from the infinitive is proagein. And that word also means pimping. So again, there's this really bawdy humor here, as well as a kind of connection between these erotic connections and philosophical inquiry. We're trying to join people together. We're trying to join people to noetic objects. We're trying to create philosophy, to create philosophical inquiry. And it's all happening in these erotic ways.
So we come full circle in the last chapter when you go back to a supposedly non-erotic dialogue, the Phaedo, and you discuss further the theory of recollection, mm-hmm. And you describe philosophy as the practice of embodied beings who are attempting, in the limited manner available to them, to reconnect to originary objects of knowledge and desire from which they are alienated, and mm-hmm. to prepare for reunification after death. Socrates, of course, in that dialogue is, he takes the hemlock and he's looking forward to it, right? I mean,
yes.
He's been preparing for this all his life, at least if what he says is to be believed. Could you discuss your interpretation of the dialogue?
Sure. So I guess I would really like to highlight 3 things from that chapter. It's a fairly lengthy chapter.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about recollection and then the connection between Phaedo and Phaedrus, and then the last part of that chapter, which really is about a connection between the Phaedo and the Odyssey. And that's where nostalgia comes in.
Right.
So I do a fairly detailed reading of the Phaedo in which I show that the introduction of recollection in this dialogue is made, again, in a highly erotic fashion. The analogy that Socrates chooses to illustrate his introduction to recollection is that recollecting the forms is like seeing the cloak or the lyre of one's lover and then being reminded of him. So it's really clear that Socrates is saying recollection is like recalling an erotic object. That's really important to me. And I really do believe that the objects of recollection and the objects of eros are the same things, these noetic objects. It's also the case that the lyre is an instrument that is associated with lyric poetry, which is the poetry that erotic, it's erotic love poetry. And of course, the cloak brings to mind the shape or the form, eidos, the look of the beloved, his body, perhaps. So I really think that this is a really highly erotically charged introduction of recollection in this particular dialogue. I'll just speak briefly on one thing. I talk later in the chapter, I do a very close reading of the eschatological myths in Phaedo and Phaedrus. And I won't go into details here, but I look at their typology and I again go back to the issue of guidance. What I said about the Phaedrus and guidance and being led in our earthly human embodied lives, I now try to think about guidance and being led in the afterlife in these two myths. So I want to talk about the Odyssey, I think that's an important part of this chapter, and again, touches on this issue of nostalgia that you asked about. So first of all, our word nostalgia comes from two Greek words, nostos, which is the Greek term for a homecoming, a journey home. And it's typically a journey that has a lot of obstacles to it and overcoming in order to get there. So the Odyssey, of course, is our paradigmatic nostos story, but there were others in the Greek world. The Greek word algos is pain. So the word nostalgia is this sort of homesickness or home pain. It's this pain or longing for the home because you're not there. So what I try to do in the last part of this chapter is to think about the Phaedo and really Socrates' entire life as it's depicted in Plato's world as a kind of nostos story, as a traditional homecoming story in which he's met with all kinds of obstacles and challenges before he returns home. There is some fascinating work done by classicists on etymological connections between nostos and nous, or in its older form, noos, and I should give credit. This is Nagy and Lochterman and Frame. Mm-hmm. And collectively, their work traces the ways in which the Odyssey plays on these puns. You know, they're saying Homer is punning on these two terms, nous and nostos, through the many names and epithets in the Odyssey story. And more pointedly, they argue that Odysseus himself is the locus of the coincidence of these two terms. What they mean is Odysseus's very return home, his nostos, depends on his intelligence, his nous. So his nostos is his nous. It's very, very interesting work. So I look back to two of the stories in the Odyssey, and these are two stories in which the homecoming is really threatened. And in particular, it's threatened because of hampering of memory recollection. So if you look at the Lotus Eaters and when Circe is keeping the men on the with her, the role of memory and recollection is central to both of those. So Circe feeds the men a drug that will make them forget their home in order to keep Odysseus there. But of course, the drugs don't work on him. And he retains the power of the memory of home and fights to release them. When Odysseus's men are among the Lotus Eaters, also they lose interest in returning home. And Homer says that all the memory of their home was dissolved and that Odysseus's intercession prevents them from forgetting, right? So this memory of home is what keeps them on their sojourn. So this provides the basis for my claim that death is a kind of homecoming, a place from which we've been separated or alienated, and that recollection reminds us of that originary home. And I go on then to look at many, many instances in the Phaedo where Plato is echoing all kinds of Homeric modes of expression and symbols, including pretty vivid nautical imagery. And this nautical imagery, you know, there's the second sailing. People know about that. It's probably the most famous. But there are other instances. And then also the afterlife, these myths that I mentioned briefly before, and the topology there is about these flowing waters that return us to where we need to go. So this originary home to which we're returning then brings me back full circle to a connection with Timaeus, that it's this reunification or disalienation from those originary noetic objects that we were alienated from when we became individuated souls that brings us full circle back to the Timaeus.
So we're close to running out of time, but I did want to also get to the very fun discussion that you have also in the same chapter about the pun with Socrates as he grows, colder and more rigid as the hemlock, creeps up from his feet. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So this begins with It's actually not original to me, but Eva Cools, in her book, The Reign of the Phallus, she points out that this scene where he talks about his becoming cold and stiff and so forth, that there are puns in this passage. The word is psuku, that has these different meanings, and it can, in fact, mean an erection. So she sort of takes that really seriously.
Okay, so I like to ask as a final question, what sort of work you see yourself, what sort of direction you see yourself going in next?
Well, I have three projects right now. One is in ancient, well, I guess they're all in ancient philosophy. Only one is in Plato, doing Plato. So we talked earlier about the Republic, and I'll confess that the Republic was really a bugaboo through this whole project. I found myself continually being sucked into talking about it when it really wasn't what I wanted to talk about. And I started to think of the Republic as this sort of playground bully among the dialogues, because it throws its weight around, even though you know, the ideas in it are really inconsistent with a lot of things that are in other dialogues. So one of the things I'm working on and hope to have done very, very soon is a treatment of Eros in the Republic, where I go back to some of the questions you asked me about, Carrie, about Eros and Epithumia. It's a little bit different in the Republic. The other two projects I have going right now are, they're sort of cousins to each other, and they both are on Aristotle. They stemmed from some activist work on my own campus with regard to gender pay equity. And I began asking the question whether people could be held accountable, morally accountable, for their perceptions. And I use Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics to argue, in fact, that perception does fall under the category of the voluntary, and we can be held accountable for our perceptions. And I want to – so one paper is about just a close reading of the Ethics, making that argument. The second paper then spins off from that and looks specifically at gender bias and perception in gender bias, and asking about moral culpability for those kinds of biased perceptions.
Do you include things like various implicit biases?
Yes, yes, indeed. And there's so many wonderful psychological studies that I think I can draw from that help to kind of gird up the philosophical argument that I want to make.
Cool. Well, I think we are out of time at this point, but I do want to thank you for such a great interview.
Oh, thank you very much. And again, I'm just so thrilled to have the opportunity. And thank you for doing such a careful job reading my book. I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, thank you again. And we'll be listening to this very soon.
Okay. Thanks, Carrie.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Jill Gordon, Charles A. Dana Professor of Philosophy at Colby College, about her new book, Plato's Erotic World, just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.